Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Welcome to Palate Exposure Podcast, where we practice passion. I'm your host, Ilona Thompson, and my guest today is none other than Gary Fish of Gary's Wine Marketplace. I have now watched and admired Gary for the past decade or so raise his paddle high at Premier Napa Valley, the most coveted trade auction in the country that offers tiny 5 to 10 case lots of super premium Napa wines. If you wish to find an unsung hero in the wine business, you might be surprised as to who it might actually be. Your neighborhood wine shop works hard at providing you with the best fit for your wallet and your palate, yet rarely gets the kind of glory that the vintners, winemakers, and sommeliers get. Gary's Wine and Marketplace started in New Jersey in 1987 as a small retail shop and has since grown to 4 northern New Jersey stores and a thriving online e-commerce business. His fifth is about to open, coming this fall, in South St. Helena at the former Dina DeLuca space. There's quite a bit of symbolism to it. When Fish first visited Napa Valley, all the way back in 1979, he was a sales rep for a wholesaler in New Jersey. His very first stop was Louis Martini Winery. And guess what? 4 decades later, he's opening a store right across the street. Welcome, Gary. We're absolutely thrilled to have you and get to know you personally and professionally.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Edison, New Jersey, of all places.
Of course.
I'm born and raised in New Jersey. This is first venture outside of the state.
Wow, that is really something. So, large family, small?
Two brothers. I'm the youngest of three children. Okay. As my father would say, I was a mistake, so I was late in the game.
Brilliant mistake.
I agree. Brilliant mistake. Actually, Brilliant Mistake happens to be one of my favorite Napa Valley wines.
You're kidding.
Fantastic wine.
Oh my God. Serendipity. So your dad, your mom, what were they doing professionally?
My father was a liquor salesman.
Okay. So there's some connection.
So he had bounced from a few different jobs running his own business, a trucking company in probably the mid-60s to early 70s. And he became a liquor wholesaler as I was growing up. And I went off to college. He was working for Fedway, a medium-sized liquor company in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated college in 1979, the question was, what was I going to do with my life?
Right.
And I never thought about a job. You know, college for me was about learning and growing and having a good time.
Yeah, of course, naturally.
More on the good time than it was about a career.
Yeah.
And around graduation time, my father, who was in his mid-60s, mm-hmm. Said, what do you want to do? Hmm. And I said, I hadn't thought about it. He said, why don't you start selling liquor? I'm going to retire soon. Maybe, you know, take over some of my accounts, you know, the run. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure, why not? I'd spent 4 years in college drinking, so I understood the concept of alcohol very well, and I was president of my university for 2 years.
Oh my goodness.
So I knew how to sell myself. Hmm. So I figured, why not sell liquor?
So you had PR skills, you had drinking skills.
Exactly. Communication skills.
Yes.
So it seemed like a natural fit. It was not such a natural fit. You know, here I was a 21-year-old kid, barely shaved, going out to call on accounts. My father made it very clear to the company that hired me, same company he worked for, Fedway, that I shouldn't be given anything, that I needed to earn my way.
Very so healthy.
They gave me, well, at the time I didn't think it was so healthy.
No, I'm kidding, but I was talking parenting skills.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I was earning $30 a week in a straight commission job.
Wow.
And you know, and thinking back now, it's kind of ironic and funny. Then it was hard. So yeah. They gave me a list of unsold accounts. And it was the old computer generated, literally the paper just goes pages and pages of unsold accounts. And my job was to call on them. Mm. Well, they were unsold for a reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were bars, really places I wouldn't want to go into necessarily. Mm-hmm. But you go in and you try to sell anything you can sell. And it was a humbling experience, to say the least.
Sounds good.
Not very enjoyable and not very profitable. Ironically, my first summer, it was a union wholesaler. And they had, which is rare that a sales job, commission sales job would be union, but it was. Mm-hmm. And there was a forced closing. So they close every summer for 2 weeks back then. Now it's 1 week. And so it was, I had a vacation. I just started full time and had a vacation. And one of my college buddies lived in LA. And I said, why don't we get together? And the school I went to was Rider University and had a great accounting program. Mm. And he was an accountant. And he said, if you go to any wineries, it's a tax deduction. So we met in San Francisco, drove up to Napa Valley. I had one Napa winery, and it was Louis Martini. And it was this time of year, and it was a little early, about 2 weeks earlier. Mm-hmm. And it was harvest. It was a very early harvest. And I went, and I'm meeting with the CEO of Martini Winery.
How about that?
I'm like, wow, this is cool. I wonder, you know, CEO. And I'm like, I'm Gary Fish. I'm here to see Mr. Martini. And a farmer came up to me. I didn't realize that there was agricultural involved in growing grapes. I never even, you know, I never put it together. I thought it was manufacturing a product, which is Cabernet. I didn't really didn't think about it, right? The only winery I had visited really before was Manischewitz. In Brooklyn.
That's
and
right.
There's no grapes involved.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see the grapes come in. They come in on train cars from upstate New York. You don't really see them. So
yeah.
Here, there's vineyards everywhere. There were grapes coming in on trucks. And there was a farmer named Louis Martini. And he was going to take this kid from Jersey and show me around. And he literally had me taste grapes that come on it. Back then, I was 18-wheelers. You know, it's not now. I see trucks going by and they're in the bins. You know,
oh, yeah.
Everything has gotten so much more sophisticated.
It's so micro,
But back then, the truck would go on. You know, mm-hmm. the scale, and it was a huge truck filled with grapes. Mm-hmm. And he had me taste grapes from the top and grapes dug down, and you could taste the difference because they had already started. They picked in the morning or during the day, and it was hot, and so they already started to ferment. So I could taste the difference. He took me into the back. Showed me one of the vineyards and explained, you know, vineyard management and trellising. And then he took me into the cellar and we tasted. Back then they had tons. They had Johannesburg Riesling, Dry Riesling, Barbera, Zinfandel,
yeah.
Mountain Red, I think it was called.
That I haven't
heard. Screwtop, you know.
Okay.
Chardonnay, Pinot Chardonnay.
Of course, yeah, that's one of my favorites.
And I was like blown away by this whole experience. And I came back and I literally was selling very little liquor,
mm-hmm.
if any, you know. And to make $30 a week, you don't have to, that's not big sales. And I came back and I said, you know, my friend Louis Martini makes wine. Why sell Dewar Scotch or Johnny Walker or another spirit when I could sell my friend's Cabernet?
I love how you say my friend. So that emotional connection formed right away.
And so I took a bunch of Kevin Zarelli's Windows of the World,
mm-hmm.
Which in the early 80s was the place to go.
Yeah, of course.
I started really talking to my restaurants and liquor stores about wine. And back then we were 5% commission. A case of Scotch was about $100. $5 commission.
Mm-hmm.
Case of Louis Martini wine, $16.
Quite a difference.
The winemaker, the liquor salesman weren't talking wine, so they never thought about it. Where for me, I wasn't selling any liquor, so for me to sell the wine and created a connection that really propelled me into the wine side of sales.
Mm-hmm. So was that an outlier, Louis Martini experience, or did you develop an interest in wine in general?
Well, that, you know, so that trip, I always talk about Martini, but the second stop was Wente in Livermore. Met Carolyn Wente.
Yeah, cool.
And they were predominantly white, where Louis Martini was predominantly red. And so it was an outlier. No, it became an immediate way of life almost. Oh. I realized that the wine tasted better with food.
Wow.
Where Scotch didn't.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
for sure.
And it was exciting. Every time I drank a glass of wine, it tasted different. You know, every time you have a distilled spirit, it should taste, you know, vodka's vodka. No offense to vodka. But it should taste like a neutral spirit. You know, whiskeys and bourbons now are creative and taste different, but a bottle of Blanton's should always taste like Blanton's. A bottle of Napa Valley Cabernet should taste different every time you taste it, every vintage and every producer.
Yeah.
Even if it comes from the same soil, if the winemaker is different, if the use of barrels are different, it's going to taste different.
Yeah.
That's exciting to me. You know, if I have it with a hamburger versus a piece of fish, it's going to taste totally different.
Has that excitement changed or waned any from those years, the early beginnings?
No. It's funny.
I knew the answer from the expression of your eyes because you look happy.
I am so happy. You know, you think about it. I'm in the wine business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the hospitality business. I'm not sure what business I'm in. We make people happy, right? It's beverage.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, but it's something that people love. It's people collect it, people drink it, people share it. One of my jokes, you don't collect shoes, do you?
No.
Good. People that collect shoes, and I know a lot of guy friends that collect shoes, women collect shoes, you know, it's their thing. They buy a shoe for every event. They don't share them.
Nope.
They put them on and wear them. Wine, everybody wants to share it. Oh my God, I got a great new wine I want you to taste. I've been saving this wine for a special occasion. Having this wine with you is my special occasion. And so for me, that's exciting. You know, we've been interviewing people to run our wine department here.
Yeah.
And nothing gets me more excited than hearing somebody say, when a guest comes back and tell me about the wine that they had and how much they enjoyed it. That's what it's all about. It's so exciting.
Those relational aspects that you're Absolutely. Describing so eloquently, I mean, they haven't changed, period. That's the fundamentals of what wine should be.
Right. Clearly, there's more big business, you know, and corporate
right.
involvement.
Right.
But there's also an opportunity every day
yeah.
for me to sell a friend's wine.
Yeah.
And there's no greater feeling. It's unbelievable.
You know, it's so gratifying to just watch you. Things change when you talk about it. And the fact that you've embraced it so early on, and you were, you know, it's very useful to be ahead of the game in any context, but in this case, you really embrace those fundamentals so, and they're so close and near dear to your heart. And as your career progressed, that had to have been the foundational aspect of it all.
Absolutely. And back then, I never thought about it. You know,
right.
it was never...
It was not conscious.
It was never a plan.
Yeah.
It was an accidental, you
yeah.
know, and that's how it worked,
yeah.
right? I became a liquor salesman.
Yeah.
Couldn't sell liquor, so I started focusing on wine. Wine started growing.
Yes. So the category started growing, and you were kind of evolving with that. How did your journey translate from selling wine to becoming an owner of the wine store?
Another accident. So I really started promoting wine to my accounts. And one of my accounts was in a situation where he needed to sell a store. And it was in what he perceived as an up-and-coming wine market, where the other store he had was an old-style liquor store on a highway,
mm-hmm.
very transient, very liquor-oriented, beer liquor-oriented.
Sure.
And this store that he wanted to sell was tiny, 1,200 square feet, did virtually no business. And he called me into his office one day and he said, "Kid," I was 28, going on 29, and he said, I got to sell my store in Madison. Would you be interested in buying it? And I'm like, the way I do everything, I thought about it for a second. I said, sure, sounds like a great idea. And he told me the price, and I said, well, I have no money. So he said, well, if you can come up with a down payment, it's yours. So I'm like, okay, I still have no money. So I called my brother, who's 10 years older, and I said, would you be interested in going into retail wine business with me? And he said, sure. So he called, said, let me talk to my wife, and called me back and said, we're in, we'll split whatever it takes. So now I still had no money.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we did what every good business person does, and that's go into debt. We just bought a house, and so we had a new mortgage. So we let the credit cards back up, and we figured out a way to come up with a down payment. The person who sold us this store structured the deal, the payout, based upon what he thought we could pay. Mm-hmm. And he held the paper, which in this day and age is
unheard of. Yeah.
And he made it clear that the store would never do enough business to support our families, and that he thought it would be a great sideline.
Where did that come from within you? I mean, somebody offers you a store, and most people's reaction would be, oh my God, no.
Maybe I'm not that deep of a thinker. I never even thought of that. You know, I was like, wow, I love the location. You know, it's in a great town. I'm like, and I asked Liz, my wife, and as she's always done, she's like, sure, if you want to do it, do it.
What a supportive wife.
And so we dove into it. You know, we just said, well, why? It seemed like a logical thing. It was, we were young. Yeah. Why not? It gave me a chance. I worked with my brother, you know, and being 10 years older, we never really worked together. Yeah. So that was kind of a cool experience. But at the end of the day, it was really, yeah, let's do it.
Why not?
Why not? There were some pitfalls early on. Our first manager stole from us. And within 3 months or 4 months of buying the store, we were out of money. So we were struggling to pay our bills. So it was very traumatic at that point, and nerve wracking. You know, now you're like, you know, what do we do? And what I did is I do what I always do. I just worked harder. You know, tried to, you know, had less employees. We had virtually no employees. It was really just at one point me, my brother. Mm-hmm. Liz was our cashier on weekends because she worked. She had a full time job, and I think our first full time employee. It was a couple of years later.
What was the hardest during those early days? Was it really running a business? Was it the inventory? Was it customer relations, vendor relations? What gave you the most heartburn?
Customer relations was always the easiest, you know, because I would taste the wine. Mm-hmm. I'd buy the wine. I'd sell the wine. It was a one man. My brother did all the back, you know. I never rang a register. That was just never.
Okay, so you were on the floor selling, and your brother was administrative.
My mind does not work that way to run a register. I could never do that. So he did all the invoicing and paying the bills and receiving the goods. You know, a truck would show up. I would take the truck stuff off the truck. I'd put it on the shelf. He would do everything, and then I would sell the wine. The hardest was managing the issues, right? First, it was somebody stole from us, you know, a lot of money.
Right.
And then, you know, we had a couple instances where we'd have one nighttime kid and they would steal. Or we'd have, you know, the little stuff of stealing really hurt. Mm. When you don't have a lot of money, you can't afford any money to lose.
Absolutely. That kind of erodes your faith in humanity too. It's demoralizing, isn't it?
It can, but you realize that that's probably a lesser percentage of people, and it also forces you as you grow to make sure you have systems in place to manage that. It's never going to be zero, but hopefully you manage it better. Mm-hmm. But we worked, you know, it was 7 days a week, 364 days a year for 3-4 years, solid. Mm-hmm. Open to close, because that was the safest way to do it, right?
Of course.
If you're there all the time, it's hard for somebody to steal.
Yeah. So number one priority was just running the business. So I'm picturing this person who obviously is a great storyteller. I'm picking up on that very strongly. And a people person you have to be, but no formal business administrative experience, but that combination of you and your brother really worked well. You were pretty cohesive as a team,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and work ethic, right? You know,
work ethic, staunch.
You know, you get up in the morning.
Yeah.
We were very fortunate in the strip center. We had, you know, it was almost like Jan Filovitz Day.
Yeah.
We had a pizza place. We had a bakery. We had McDonald's or some burger joint.
Right.
We had the worst food ever. It was terrible, but it was a Chinese restaurant. So every day I would get there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I would get the store ready to open. We would open. Salesman would come. I'd buy.
Wow.
The next day the truck would come. I'd put it away. And then as we got busier, we couldn't fit everything in the store.
Right.
So the trucks would leave it on the porch, we called it. So if you picture a strip mall, they would leave everything on the outside. Throughout the day, if somebody wanted a case of Doers, I would just grab it from this sidewalk and put it in their car. And then at the end of the day, I would hand truck everything in, put it in the aisles. And then every morning I'd get there at 7, take everything. And the idea would be by Monday morning, there'd be nothing left.
Yeah.
So that when we started getting reorders on Tuesday, we'd have a place to put it. So it was very energetic.
I can see that. Did you get burned out a little bit, or were you always kind of re-energized by?
Yeah, no, I never got burned out. I don't think that way. You know, there were days I was tired. There was days I was sore.
Yeah.
But I never didn't jump out of bed in the morning.
Oh.
Never thought that way. It's like, okay, we got work to do today. Let's hopefully we'll bring more money in than goes out.
So the store was doing well. Obviously, at some point, that critical mass hit when all the hard work started.
So the store started doing very well.
Yeah.
There was a Chinese restaurant that we used to eat at that the landlord called us and he was going out of business.
Hmm.
And did we want the space?
Yeah.
We said, absolutely. So we took over the space. So we went from 12,000 square feet that we bought in 87 around 1991, 92, we took over the Chinese restaurant, which was like 3,500 square feet, 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran that for about 2 years. And during that period, a gentleman came in that was a lawyer. And he asked my brother and I if we had a business relationship. In writing,
yeah,
a buy-sell agreement, any of that. And we're like, no. He said, why don't you come to my office and I'll write one for you. And we're like, we don't really have a budget to do that.
Mm.
He said, look, you're a nice guy. He'd come in the store. He just got into wine. I'll do you a favor. I'll just write a one-pager for you. Mm. Something that's if something goes wrong. It's easy when everybody's getting along to have a business relationship.
Yeah.
It's harder if something goes wrong. So we said, sure. So he wrote it. About 3 months later, a car dealership down the street from us, a sign went up for rent.
Mm-hmm.
And we called and nobody answered. You know, they wouldn't get back to us. We left a message. And so I called this lawyer friend, now he's a friend, up and said, hey, do you know, could you... Because he said if we ever needed anything.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the location? So I know the landlord. So we had a lease done within a month. And we moved in. And at that point, he asked if we would want him to invest. So he invested. He became our first outside investor. He's my partner today.
So cool.
And we went from 4,000 or just under 4,000 to 10,000. Which we've since renovated, and that became 13,000.
Wow.
And that was a turning point in a bazillion ways.
Yeah.
One is we went from 5 employees to 25, give or take. We went, and it was a big, you know, it's an old car dealership, right? So in the world of my stores today, it was small. In the world of 1,200 square feet to 3,000 or 4,000 to 10,000. It was huge. And when we gutted it, I looked, I'm like, this is too big, you know. A, I'll never be able to fill it, which is not true. I filled it very quickly.
Yeah.
B, I don't want to be a warehouse at that point. When we first started, the name of the store was Shoppers Discount Liquor. That's when we bought it. We added Wine Warehouse to the name. Mm-hmm. Because I want them to be perceived as big. Wine Warehouse sounds big.
Yes.
So when you're 1,200 square feet and you're a little guy in town, you want to be big. So mm-hmm. I added Wine Warehouse to the name. Now we're taking over 10,000 square feet and I wanted to be small. And I didn't want to compete with big.
Yeah.
So I said, we got to do something different. And I had been on a trip to Italy. And you go into the Italian markets and you're like, the cheese is stacked up and charcuterie and...
Oh, yes. It's a visual feast.
And I'm like, we need to do that. So we went into the cheese business and charcuterie business. Hmm. And because of where the store is located, it immediately got a clientele of the international... There's a lot of international corporations.
Oh, okay.
So we started getting a huge English population. So we brought in English foods. We got into good breads, because if you have cheese and charcuterie, you need bread.
Yeah.
And then we went into some pastry. And so it helped us evolve to become more than just a discount liquor store.
And you were ahead of the game.
There was nobody doing that in New Jersey at the time. Yeah. Nobody. You know, people were starting to get into wine.
Yeah.
Liquor stores became wine and liquor stores. But nobody was doing cheese. And some people had, like, I call them coffin cases, which is just the reach-in cryovac cheese, like grocery store cheese.
Sure.
I'm like, if we're going to do cheese, we need to do cheese the same way we do wine, which is handcrafted, hand-cut, fresh. So there's a store in the city that I admired, and I hired a cheese person, sent her into the city to learn from this guy. Ideal Cheese, I think his name was Ed from Ideal Cheese. So worked in the city for a couple of weeks. He came out and consulted by having his name associated. All the little boutique-y, egotistical cheese companies were willing to deal with us.
Mm.
So we became known for cheese. And shortly after, a store in Bernardsville, the landlord called us and said, I want that concept in my space. I had a lawyer partner, so he was able to turn it into a lease relatively quickly. And that's how the growth began.
It sounds very organic. It's almost as if step by step things reveal themselves and you captured the opportunity.
Look, it sounds great to say I'm a guru. I never had a plan. This is not a plan, and we'll get to that. This was not my dream plan. This was another accident. So yeah, I mean, so we went from little to big. Big to a second big, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then a third big. And in that time, we realized Shoppers Discount Liquor no longer works. It just doesn't work anymore
mm-hmm.
as a name, right?
Because
we're cheese, we're more than that.
Yeah.
And my brother had retired,
okay.
Which goes back to having a great buy-sell agreement because he was 10 years older.
Mm-hmm.
He had decided it was time not to work like a lunatic like I am.
Yes.
And so we did that, and so I became the primary owner with the one investor. And so we're like, Shoppers Discount Liquor Wine Warehouse doesn't resonate, you know? So we hired a facilitator. I've never spent any money on marketing or sales or anything.
Facilitator.
It sounds good, right? What did they
yes.
do? We paid them. We brought in a bunch of customers to one of our stores. We brought mm-hmm. them breakfast. And they sit around a table, and he had the whiteboard. That was the facilitator's job. I think that was his only job, whiteboard. You know? So he said to everybody, what's the name of the store you're in today? Well, that's an interesting question. And we're spending a couple hundred thousand dollars a year at that point on advertising.
Hmm.
It was World of Liquor, Wine Liquor, Warehouse Liquors, Shoppers World, Shoppers Discount, Shoppers Warehouse. There was no one name.
Hmm.
Everybody had a different, and some of the people said, well, it depends on what I'm thinking at that time.
Yeah.
So the facilitator said, well, what do you tell people where you're going Saturday? Oh, I'm going to have Gary pick out some wine for me.
Brilliant.
So he wrote Gary. And then, of course, the whole thing, the controversy was, well, if your name was Pierre, Pierre sounds like a wine shop. Gary doesn't sound like a wine shop. And I'm like, I'm not smart enough to change my name, so we're going to keep it Gary. So then it became Gary's. And then we said, okay, we're more than just liquor, so it can't be Gary's liquor.
Yeah.
We're not just wine, so it can't be Gary's wine. We're really a marketplace. So it became Gary's Wine and Marketplace. So that was almost planned, but not really.
So anybody that's thinking that was perhaps an egotistical move to put your name, it couldn't be further from the truth.
And that was another... It was an accident because they named it. I didn't, you know. And then we hired at that point our first PR firm.
Yeah.
An ad agency, because now we have to brand it, you know. And,
yes.
And this was in 2000-ish, 2001.
Okay.
And so the PR firm said, well, we can't promote a building. We promote a person.
Yes.
And at the time, they were promoting Windows of the World. But they weren't promoting Windows of the World. They were promoting Kevin Zarelli.
Yeah.
And Andrea Emmer, who's Andrea Robinson.
Yes, that's right. No, she was definitely an up-and-coming star then.
Yeah. So they said, if we're going to promote, we're promoting you.
Yeah.
Not the building. I'm like, okay. What does that mean? It means you're... face has to be the company, right? It's not just a building. So the next thing I know, we had billboards with my face on it. We had ads with my face on it. And you may find it hard to believe, a lot of it was tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
We had one billboard, a store of ours was off a circle, and there was a big billboard right on the circle. So they did a profile. And it was the best wine shop in New Jersey is right under your nose. And it won
great.
An award.
That's great.
So, and it created activity. So it could appear egotistical, I guess, because it's my pictures everywhere. But I'm building a brand, you know, and the brand is Gary's.
So at that point, you have four stores.
At that point, it was really three stores.
Three, okay. How did the e-commerce start? Was it just a natural progression, the extension?
Yeah, because people were doing e-commerce.
Yeah.
And so we started, you know, I think Wine Access hosted our first site.
Oh, okay.
And we did it almost as a, you know, one of the wine associates was in charge of e-commerce. So he sent out some emails periodically. Mm-hmm. You know, we got some orders, we signed people up, started growing. When we opened up Wayne, our biggest store, 24,000 feet, that gave us an opportunity to have an e-commerce zone.
Sure.
So for pack and ship and fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we brought on people that were focused on e-commerce, mm-hmm. as opposed to wine people that also fulfilled e-commerce.
From the wine purchasing perspective specifically, how did you build your inventory? What was the drive? What were the driving factors behind your purchasing?
Well, back in the day, it was customer demand, which was usually brand identified, right?
Right.
You know, our first big Chardonnay was Kendall Jackson. Ironically, it's still our number one selling Chardonnay.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I did that. I did a Chardonnay symposium last year, and so I checked our numbers, you know, I ran the reports, which I haven't really looked at closely, and Kendall Jackson every year is still our number one selling Chardonnay. It's a testament to the, probably the quality, you know, because everything's changed.
Yes.
But that people still buy it at the price point. But so some of it was consumer driven, you know, kind of seeing where the consumer, and other, it was my, what I liked, because it's so much easier to sell something you like, and you're more real and legit, and I can't be somebody else. It's just I'm not good at that. I'm good at being me. And so I taste something, I like it. You come in, I sell it to you. You like it, I sell you more. You don't like it, I find out why you didn't like it and sell you something else.
So initially there were known brands in your stores, and then when you started expanding into international market.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the bigger we got, yeah, the more you had to diversify.
Sure.
So I've always said we may not have the biggest selection of everything, but we have the most well-planned selection of everything.
Well-planned. Tell me about that piece.
So, you know, you look and you say, Bordeaux.
Yeah.
There are stores probably in New York that have a larger selection.
Right.
Although, with its 16 vintage, I could argue that we probably have one of the largest selections in the country. But we would, you know, Burgundy, we would pick some of the best producers and then some under-the-radar producers. And that's what we kind of started doing. And that was more, again, random, right? Because it's agricultural, as I learned.
Sure.
So, you know, Kendall Jackson, you may have for a year.
Yeah.
You know, they may be able to roll vintage to vintage. But some of these smaller producers, you may only have for 3 months.
Right.
Until they run out. So you find something else. It also makes it fun, right? Because you're always buying and selling and tasting and playing. And it's fun. It's different. As long as you manage your inventory.
Initially, you had to have taken 100% ownership of the choices of wines. But as your business grew, you obviously were more of a leadership role, right? And you created a crew and, you know, group of employees that hopefully were not just like mine in terms of the business acumen and such like that and the vision overall, but also had their own palace, their own perspective on what the wine world looks like and feels like. How does that dynamic work?
That was the most challenging. Not a bad challenge, but a challenge, right? So I'm used to, you know, I taste, I buy, I sell, I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, I go from one, you know, when we had two stores, you bounce from store to store, buying and selling and tasting. Now, you know, we're at 4 stores in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And so I hired a Sam Brooke, mm-hmm, fantastic palate, and she heads the wine team.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an Italian buyer, mm-hmm, Cesare Martini. His grandfather founded Martini Rossi.
How cool is that?
It is unbelievable, and he is all things Italian. He's so passionate Italian.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's awesome, but Italians live in a different time zone.
Island time?
but he's passionate.
Yes.
I have Scott, who does, he's got the biggest challenge. He does America. Mm. And our winery direct. Mm. Why does he have a biggest challenge? Come on, you should know the answer by now.
Oh, the biggest challenge is winery direct.
No, it's the biggest challenge because that's the area that I'm still involved in.
So he's always we need to edit that out.
He's always over budget. I'll put him on a budget. I'll say, look, you know, our inventory is too high in domestic, which means too high in Napa.
Yeah.
I'll come back from a trip and I'll have bought 500 cases. He says, Gary, I'm going to be over budget. I'm like, well, it's your fault, not mine. And then I have Lisa, who does Southern Hemisphere. So we now have 4 buyers.
Okay.
And one, what I'll call a reorder generator. And he just, if it's an item that we have approved, he just looks at reorders and brings them back in.
Okay.
So it's become, so we have wine team meetings now. We taste as a committee. And we buy as a team.
Okay. So as far as specifically Scott and the winery direct, tell me more about this. What is the criteria by which you choose wines besides the obvious? I mean, we're all biased. I don't care what anybody says. We all have biases. Beyond that, what does it look like? Do you look at a certain vintage and calibrate to that? Or relationships you formed? That's a biggest driving characteristic? What are the tenets of it?
Well, there's a couple factions of it, we'll call it, right? There's what I'll call other people's produced, not national brands, that are winery direct to us,
mm-hmm,
where a small winery is producing a wine that is not national and may not have a marketing team or whatever.
Right.
And they can sell us 50 cases a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their wine, they make it, that, you know, they've branded it. They may get ratings, they may not. So those we taste if we like, that becomes part of the direct to Gary.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There are other people that are bigger companies that produce private label.
Right.
We have some of those that are direct to Gary. And we have them from Italy, Argentina. The advantage of having gotten bigger is buying capacity, right? We could buy much more now.
Yeah.
So we're buying direct from Spain, Italy, France, you know, the entire world, mm-hmm. including domestic.
Right.
The third part and the most enjoyable part is our branded products, which mm-hmm. are going forward.
That's exciting.
GF, Gary Fish.
Uh-huh.
Go figure.
Go figure. Okay.
GF.
Okay.
Get the theme.
Yes.
Grand finale.
Okay.
GF.
Okay.
And Fish.
Is that the flagship?
No, it's there's no flagship. So if you think the way we've kind of designed it mm-hmm. is going forward is the same winery fruit every year, same winery.
Okay.
From the same vineyards mm-hmm. going forward. Mm-hmm. It's made by a world, you know, recognized Napa and Sonoma wine group. They have wine, they own a winery in Napa, they own a couple in Sonoma, and they buy a lot of fruit, and they grow a lot of fruit.
Maybe and know what it is?
What?
Maybe know what the group's
Maybe.
Name is? Okay. And earn that. Sorry, guys.
they produce the going forward for us. So we meet with them, taste with their... in this case, they're Burgundy-style wine team. So it's mostly, it's all Sonoma fruit. So okay. they have a team that does Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. So they make that for us. Fish is made, is actually from Rutherford, but it's Napa Cab. It's Napa Cab and Napa Sauvignon Blanc. And that's made the same year, same every year by a winery. Mm-hmm. A fantastic winery in Rutherford. And then Go Figure is lot driven. So, and that was the beginning of our program was Go Figure. That was really the first.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.